It's a bit of a romp, this, and I've tried to, as I said when I arrived here, Oxford seemed to rest on tacit rules, and everyone has their own take on what those rules are. So I asked around about what these lectures should be about, and I got about five different versions, and I thought, well, I'll do what I feel like doing anyway. And but one of the things was to take people through the way one's thinking and one's research has evolved. So I'm doing that, really. And the everydayness remark in here is about trying to understand the things which are maybe invisible but do have an impact on the way we think and feel. To do that, I'm going to do a very quick run-through of one aspect of the Russian theory which influences my work, and then show you quite a lot of data, which I've gathered over the years, which I find provocative and help me to think through more of the theoretical issues that I play with. So that ricochet between data and theory is kind of embedded in what I'm going to do this evening. And this is a stolen woodcut, and it kind of, as a way of introducing what the Vygotskian argument is about, I find helpful. Here are some musicians looking at written musical notation. Of course, people have sung and made music for centuries, but when music was introduced, it allowed them to make music or think about music in a different sort of way. And these are merchants looking at account books. Radio 4 recently a year ago, did a whole series on the impact of double-entry bookkeeping into Venetian society, and argued that that produced the wealth that led to the Renaissance. The introduction of a new tool into a social practice transformed that social practice in such a way that they made lots of money and had the possibility of investing something. And of course, what we, most of us anyway in the room, do is bring new tools to the lives of our students, whether they're children or adults. We pick things from our cultures that have developed through our cultures, and set up circumstances in which the people we're working with can acquire those tools and use those tools. So the Vygotskian argument about the social formation of mind, one, has an emphasis on the introduction of new tools for human activity, which not only improves a particular kind of functioning, it changes it. These are cultural historical products which mediate thinking and feeling, and the feeling, of course, has been left out in recent years. So if you look at the work, it does look remarkably as if it's just a cognitive enterprise. It isn't. But these tools are in turn shaped and transformed through their use. These are not static things, they evolve. And that it's here where psychological and cultural historical processes are interwoven and co-create each other. Now, he put particular emphasis on the linkage between consciousness and semiosis, particularly linguistic semiosis, and thus links the specifically human aspect of our practical and mental life to socio-historical context. The primacy of the social is the major play. And inside this is the notion of mediation, that we never operate directly on the world. It's always mediated, particularly by signs, and that these and the emergence and very definition of psychological processes are grounded in this notion of mediation for the Russian writers. But also, it's not just words that do this. So people like the Russian philosopher Ilyenkov, who has been brought to public attention quite considerably by David Backhurst, who works at, who's head of the philosophy department at Queen's in Ontario. Well, yes, Ontario. And he's looked at the way in which it's not only words but things mediate our engagement with the world. So if you look around some of the people in this room, they'll be wearing a lump of metal around their finger. And it's more than just a lump of metal. It it's social in social cultural artifacts in two senses. One, as my kids used to do when they were traveling when they were students, they used to wear a lump of metal on their wedding finger for obvious reasons. It was saying, I am not available, thank you. But secondly, if we're burgled and somebody, say, steals a ring that was your grandmother's or was your wedding ring, you're very upset, not because of the value of the thing itself, but what's sedimented in it, the memory of it being given, the memory of the event that was associated with it. So if you speak to the children of diplomats, they'll say something like, well, it was always strange as a kid. My real life followed 6 months after I moved location. The stuff that had meaning came afterwards. So also when you're burgled, if someone steals your TV, by and large, you don't give a damn. You just go to Curry's and get another one. But if they take the necklace that your grandmother used to wear, you're very upset because of the meaning that's sedimented inside that. So that's another... So it's not just words and signs, it's things as well, which are important in this argument. And that this rests on the notion of the meaning that's encoded in these mediating systems. And this can be done in a variety of ways. And for those of you interested in disability, of course, there's a whole bunch of study looking at whether the same meanings are encoded in something like Braille or sign language. At one time, the Russians argued that sign language should be banned because it didn't have the same meaning capacity as natural language in Russia, and it was forbidden. In the same way that the Dutch Catholic educators in South Central Holland also banned sign language and insisted on the use of an oralist approach in the teaching of the deaf. But what the glorious thing was in Russia, of course, kids invented their own sign language. It's very useful to the mafia because they had the very street-specific sign languages, and they were very good at doing drug deals because no one knew on what on earth they were communicating about because it was very specific to particular areas. And the kids in St. Michael's Gestel used to pretend to do oralism but were signing under the table, however. The notion of mediation, and this where I come to sort of the more crunchy part of this evening's talk, Vygotsky died in 34, born in 1896. Of course, 34, by that time, Stalin was on the ascendancy. He really didn't start writing very much in the psychological frame until about 1923, 24. And there are attempts to make him look like some sort of coherent thinker. In fact, his, as with all of us, his thinking developed. So the number of people, for example, who talk about Piaget in the same sentence as something about snails, sometimes have never read the stuff that was written in the 60s, where a very, very different kind of writer in his Études Sociologiques, the Piaget you read in that is a very different character from the person who was writing in the 1960s. Well, Vygotsky certainly had two eras, one in which he was working with psychologists, teachers, and people concerned with special needs and disability, and using the professional languages of psychology and physiology. And from his early work, where he used to hang out with people like Stanislavski, Mandelstam, when he was working in drama and art, and was highly connected with the whole, what was called the Silver Age of Moscow, is connected with the artistic life of the city. And there's two influences there. And when it comes to mediation, there are two kinds of emphasis. One which has been called explicit, when somebody does something very deliberate to mediate a particular form of activity. And the example you'll find from Vygotsky is the tying of a knot in a handkerchief to deliberately try and remember something. But more recently, people like Ed Hutchins have looked at the organization of the cockpit of an aircraft or the bridge of a large military vessel. And his well-known work on how a cockpit remembers its speeds, looks at socio-technical systems and the way they organise their memory and cognitive processes. Cognitive science going beyond isolated individuals to take account of the role of cultural tools, such as gauges and instruments, in remembering and human action. So a complex thing, how things and people work together, and the introduction of particular things into a practice like steering, navigating a ship, makes a difference to the way it operates. But the stuff that I'm particularly interested comes from his earlier work, when the emphasis was on what might be called implicit mediation, where a particular focus on natural language, which are not purposely introduced. It's the everydayness stuff that's in this. They're part of a pre-existing independent stream of communicative action that becomes integrated with other forms of goal-directed behaviour. And they're often not open to conscious reflection. And the meanings that are involved in this kind of mediation, of course, develop. Now, there are some fit folks in the trade that Ian Thompson and I ply, who are almost theoretical zealots or sort of Vygotskian fundamentalists. I certainly don't fit into that camp. Because when I said imagination, like when Wright Mills wrote the book A Sociological Imagination, it's a way of thinking, a way of orienting yourself to the object of social science research. And people alight on different parts of the Vygotskian writing at different times to develop their ideas. I just like this quote. It's Andrei Puzyrai, who's still writing in Moscow now. Vygotsky's cultural historical theory, like any great theory, resembles a city with broad new avenues and ancient narrow back streets known only to long-time residents, with noisy crowded plazas and quiet deserted squares, with large modern edifices and decrepit little buildings. The individual areas of that city may not be situated on a single level. Some may rise above the ground, others are submerged below it and cannot be seen at all. In essence, it's as though there were a second city that has intimate and complex associations with a ground-level city, but completely invisible to many. And the sun rises above it all, and the stars rage out, come out over it at night. Sometimes dust storms and hurricanes rage. That's the reference to Stalin, of course. Or the rain beats down long and hard, and the sky is overcast. Life is a constant feeling of effervescence. Holidays and humdrum follow one another. The city changes, grows, and is rebuilt. Whole neighborhoods are demolished. The center is sometimes over here, sometimes over there. I think it captures to me the way in which people engage with a complex body of theoretical work. They home in on particular things at different times, take bits that fit arguments that they're having at others. It gives them a sense of imagination of the ways in which they could progress an argument which they are working on. And Vygotsky spoke a lot about the wider aspects of schooling. In this approach, this is a Belgrade-based writer, Ivic. It's quite possible to regard the school itself as a message, that is a fundamental factor of education, because as an institution, and quite apart from the contents of its teaching, it implies a certain structuring of time and space, and it's based on a system of social relations between pupils and teachers, between the pupils themselves, between the school and its surrounding, and so on. He was interested in that stuff, but, I mean, he died when he was a young man and really didn't do that much to engage with this part of it, and that is taken up by Rukaya Hassan, who's worked with Halliday for many, many years, saying that this kind of work sometimes appears to occur in a social vacuum, and overall the shape of the interaction or its context is never invoked in any way consequential to the outcome. Vygotsky often mentions the school, but in an avowedly socio-cultural theory of mental development, there seems to be no concern with the social significance of this critical site for action. And this is kind of partly about when you see these endless studies, which the social consists of two kids sitting down with a Tower of Hanoi and trying to solve the problem in that way. And that's taken as the social in the Vygotskian argument. What I'm trying to lay down tonight is a much broader, as I'll hopefully demonstrate, a much broader concern with what counts as the social in a social formation of mind argument. And that's where, as Ernesto pointed out, I look to Bernstein and his interest in the interrelations between changes in organizational form, changes in modes of control, and changes in principles of communication. So for him, influenced by Durkheim, looking at distribution of power and principles of control and their relation to principles of communication, how communication regulates relations within and between groups, and how communication also sets up the distribution of forms of pedagogic consciousness. Trying to establish that link between organizational forms and thinking and feeling, particularly through communication. And his work, whilst Jim Virscht has written of implicit mediation in Vygotsky, there are some similarities with something Bernstein called invisible semiotic mediation, which he discussed in terms of how the unself-conscious everyday discourse, the everydayness, mediates mental dispositions, tendencies to respond to situations in certain ways, how it puts in place beliefs about the world one lives in, including both about phenomena that are supposedly in nature and those that are said to be in our culture. And this he sees as starting from very early influences, very early infancy, occurs across a wide range of cultural activities, and it sets up the habits of mind which are crucial to a person's ways of engaging in the visible semiotic mediation. And it's naturalized, and it's in the sense that it's treated as the sayings and their meanings are treated as entirely natural. And talk of this kind occurs again and again, constructs a design for ways of being, doing, and saying that are viewed as legitimate within speakers' communities. What it mediates is elements of one's mental maps for living in a culture of one's own immediate community. So that's kind of quite important from where I've been working over the years. And a relation between one's social positioning, one's mental dispositions, and one's relations to the division of labour in society. I mean, sociologists have given insight onto how that operates over the decades. But emphasis on discourse is theorized not only in terms of the shaping of cognitive functions, but also, as it were, invisibly in its influences on dispositions, identities, and practices. And this gives us rules for recognizing what social activity or context is the context for, and how that activity should be carried out. What goes here? How do I do it? And this partly from Rukaya Hassan is participation in social practices, including participation in discourse, is the biggest bootstrapping enterprise that human beings engage in. Speaking is necessary for learning to speak. Engaging with context is necessary for recognizing and dealing with context. The context that one learns about are the contexts that one lives. The contexts one lives are those which are specialized to one's social position. And so there we've got this linkage between an analysis of the social, analysis of the discursive practices, and the consequences for how we think and feel. Right, that's enough of that. What I'm now going to do is to take you through some of the data I've collected over the years. I hope you find some of it mildly diverting. Some of the methodology is weak. It's exploratory. It didn't come off the shelf by and large. It was stuff that I sort of dreamt of in the bath or thought up as we went along. It's been tried out, played with, and wrestled with over the years. And the purpose, as I first thought, it was to see institutions as they do their invisible psychological work through the discursive practices which they shape and are shaped by. Okay. These are taken from a special school, two special schools. Invisible. When I was taking this photograph, the deputy head of this school came up to me and said, Harry, what are you doing? I said, I'm taking pictures of wall displays. Why? Well, I'm kind of interested in the extent to which they reflect the cultural practices of the school. At which point he said something extremely rude, which I won't repeat now, but said, I'll tell you about wall display. You get a picture from the children and you get two things. They're called drawing pins. You might not have heard of them, but they're quite good for this sort of job. And you pin it on a wall. And that's what wall display is. You're wasting public money. Stop it. He was really, really angry. For him, it wasn't a matter of something about his school. This wall display was uncontroversial. It's just what you did. Now, this was a school for children with moderate learning difficulties. And I'll show you three from one school a couple of times, and then I'll show you three from another school a couple of times. They were side by side in the same local authority. There were no differences in the demographics of the catchment. There were no differences in the qualifications of the teachers. There were no differences in the expressive and receptive language of the children, and no attainment measures showed significant differences between the schools. What's the school saying to me? This came about, it was when I was thinking, how does a school culture communicate to children what goes here? And I thought, well, one piece of work I did on how teachers mark children's work, but this was on, I think, having your work up on the wall struck me as fairly important. So let's play with that for a while. Now, you might say, well, there's a clear message here. Everyone's been given a plate, paper plate. They've been told to paint it yellow. That the eyes have a white background and a dark centre. The lips are red with a pink nose. And if you really want to, you can put eyebrows on, although someone got really, really enthusiastic about eyebrows. But let's look at the neighbouring school. Remember, you take a piece of work and you've got these two things called drawing pins, and you pin them up on the wall. So what we did was to take these and use them in a modified version of one of the techniques that George Kelly developed in his personal construct theory, although we didn't use it within that frame, within the personal construct frame. We were trying to analyse what we got out of the kids in terms of the location they were placed in. And what we did was to say, what's the same about these two and different about that one? Or what's the same about these two and different about that one? Now, on the one hand, children said things like, in this school you paint what you see, in this school you paint what the teacher sees. Now, these are 10-year-olds with moderate learning difficulties. That might sound a trivial comment. I don't think it is myself. When I've done this with HMIs in a workshop, they thought they were jolly clever being able to pick up that sort of thing. Even more sort of, well, I left these photos on a desk with a video camera up here somewhere. And the question I'd ask the children was something like, which school would you rather go to and why? And I got called out to the phone. And this group of 10-year-old girls with moderate learning difficulties were talking in one school. One little girl said, I would rather go to this school. And her friend said, why? And she said, well, it helps you to get a job. What do you mean? Well, when you go to get a job, you've got to do what you're told. And if you don't do what you're told when you get a job, you get the sack, which I think, you know, is quite powerful. But her friend said, don't be silly, go to this school, because this school teaches you to choose the right job in the first place. Generally, in the paper that's published from this work, you can see very different orientations to meaning among these two groups of kids. In the Ennis for Nose school, they were oriented to product, to ownership, and in this school, the one that's up now, they were oriented to social relations and choice. A very strong difference in the data. The next piece of work comes from two studies I undertook with the sadly no longer with us, Diana Leonard, and they were about gender, special needs, and attainment. And in this part of the study, we were looking at two kinds of schools, one set of group of schools where collaboration was the thing of the day, and another set of schools where competition was the thing of the day. I should say at the outset, when we were looking at attainment, that the schools which were competitive, girls massively outperformed the boys. Middle class girls' attainment was much, much stronger than the girls, or the boys. We'll come back to that maybe in a minute. I'm going to read out some of the interviews, partly because you probably won't believe that kids actually said what they're going to say. This is a friendship interview, group of boys, and they're talking about two girls who didn't do terribly well in class. On the other hand, I think Felicia and Aisha would probably work together all the time if they had a chance. Yeah, right. It's like the poem. They did nearly exactly the same poem. I think one of them did one idea and the other one copied. Yeah, because Ralph, who's the teacher, said they were a bit the same. You shouldn't do them together. Yeah, you should split them up. But he forgot. All the way through, these boys in a competitive school think collaboration is cheating. A bit like Neil Mercer's work, where he's got young mathematicians building castles around their work. And in this school, we had kids who would write an essay and then put copyright at the end of it. Now, this is a school in which collaboration was the order of the day. And a group of kids talking about Charlie, who's really a very difficult young man. Everybody gave it their best shot. No, everyone except Charlie, really. Oh, yeah, Charlie started in some of his work. Just colours in all the little gaps. He just does all these little things to his work, which Rebecca, who's the teacher, doesn't like. Rebecca doesn't really like. Because in his old school, he was allowed to do things. But he's new, though. There's some exceptions. Well, he's been here nearly a whole term. Huh? Yeah, well, he started about a week after we came. Yes, he has, because I remember school journey was in the second week. Yeah, school journey was in the second week. But there's an exception. He's only been here a term. Exactly. Yeah, but he's still doing stuff that he knows he shouldn't do. And he bought aftershave in one day, yeah. And he sprayed my teddy with aftershave. That was on school journey. Has your teddy recovered? Yeah, just about. It still stinks a bit. Oh, well, give it a bath. Yeah, he has to sleep at the end of my bed. This is a 10-year-old in a junior school talking about the need for a comforter, being upset that it's been impregnated with aftershave, and is openly talking about it. Could not have done it in that other school. Now, just a little reflection on the UNICEF Innocenti figures, which shows the UK at the very, very bottom of well-being scores. And that business I referred to is not just thinking from a Vygotskian perspective, it's feeling as well, and children's well-being in the classroom, and how I would say the large-scale design of schools, and I don't mean buildings here, I mean the kind of the curriculum architecture, the priorities within it have an impact not just on thinking but feeling. Do you think girls and boys learn the same or learn differently? Well, I reckon that girls learn differently because what they do is when they get a piece of work, they seem to rush it. Yeah, they sort of put it into their book, like paraphrasing it. So they've got their own reference to a piece of information they've been given. But with boys, they get that information. They sort of mold it. They sort of reshape it so it's in a different form. And they put different ideas into it. You could say that girls have a tendency to learn like people would probably learn in late Victorian times. And boys learn like most people would learn now. I think there's two ways of word learning, really. The sort of copying and getting information into your head, yeah, and getting it right. And getting it right, yeah, staying within the perimeter. You could say that then the other type is sort of learning, taking information, then putting it down in a different form, and then sort of piecing it together like a puzzle. Right, in the collaborative school, do you think boys and girls learn the same or learn differently? No, they're a different species to us. Yeah. Their brains are completely different. I mean, I read a book. I've seen this in a newspaper somewhere. And you see, it shows you the bits inside the brain that tell you to do different things. And a girl's brain looks completely different to an inside of a boy's. That was probably in The Simpsons. Yeah, that was probably on The Simpsons. Oh, yeah, it was. Oh, so you use the symptoms as guide to life. And no, that just shows girls are cleverer. Yeah, but you're a boy, but I can insult myself. Right. So there we go. Primary influence. Our argument at the end of it was that in this school where attainment levels of boys and girls were pretty close, the girls still outperformed boys, but not by very much. Whereas in the other school, it was massively so for the middle-class girls, was if young people are coming into schooling, males with slightly more orientation to competition and girls with more of an orientation to collaboration. In the other school, the girls were taught to be competitive. The boys had their competitive predisposition reinforced. So girls could do competitive, and they did. They were, they did Ladette behavior quite a lot of them, really kind of up and at it kind of young people. But if that failed, they had another place to go. They had another strategy they could use. Whereas in this school, the boys were taught about how to collaborate as well. And they had two strategies as well. And that resulted in a much more even distribution, attainment patterns. Right, let's get back to this. Anne Edwards and I then took on a four-year TLRP project on how people learn to do multi-agency working. And we looked at very different cultures of multi-agency teams in local authorities. And what we did was to analyze communicative action as mediated by the institutional context. And what we showed was that how attention is directed and deflected by the history of professional cultures in those settings. And we evidenced the ways in which the institution itself was shaped as well as shapes the possibilities for action. I'm not going any further with that now. There's an extensive, we wrote that up well and truly. But a very powerful finding inside that setting. this brings with it, for me, an expansion of the notion of mediation to include historically accumulated organizational discourse as a mediating artifact, bringing together the systemic with the interactional and examining the relationship between the regulative, the order, identity, and relation aspects of the discourse with the selection, sequencing, pacing, and criteria of evaluation, the instructional aspects of it in schooling. And trying to see how wider social structures impact on interactions between participants, their patterns of communicative action, and the work that they do. Now, we had a seminar here last week with a friend of ours, Jan Derry, who's written a book on Vygotskian philosophy. And she draws on people like McDowell to bring a notion of the space of reasons into a critique of abstract rationality, arguing that a curriculum orientation to abstract rationality is an error because rationality is always located in a space of reasons. Now, I can't go further with that now, but this quote sort of puts it in a position. Teaching involves providing opportunities for learners to use concepts in the space of reasons within which they fall and within which their meaning is constituted. Participation in this space does not presuppose a full understanding of a concept. Rather, what it is needed to start with is no more than an ability to inhabit the space in which reasons and the concept operates. So she has that critique there. And it reminds me of what Bruner said in the early 90s. When we enter human life, it's as if we walk on stage into a play whose enactment is in progress, a play whose somewhat open plot determines what parts we may play and towards what denouements we may be heading. Others on the stage already have a sense of what the play is about, enough of a sense to make negotiation with a newcomer possible. So entering into the everydayness of a setting. Now, that's where I come to the work we're up to at the moment, which, as Ernesto said, is a three-year AHRC project, and we're looking at the Blairite new cathedrals of learning, the places which would be transformative of school and community life. Huge claims. And we're looking at five newly built schools built within the last 7 years, and we're asking how do these designs impact on students, teachers and parents' engagement with the educational process. So it's another step out in terms of the scaling of the social. This is the actual, the building, the space itself that it takes place in. And this is at a time when our Secretary of State for Education has instigated a standardised approach to school buildings. There are a number of standard designs in the bowels of the DfE. So if you want to build a school now, you stop me and buy one. And architects tell us that these are remarkably similar to the ones that are being demolished at the moment. Nonetheless, what is in place at the moment is a standardisation, but with very little debate as to what should be standardised. So why do we think it's important to... I do like this young man. He's why do we think it's important to understand it? Well, Sue Leroy-Smith, who's sadly very ill at the moment, dug this one out. We shape our buildings and afterwards our dwellings shape us. Well, there's a very interesting group up at the Department of the Built Environment in Salford who, much to the annoyance of the government, are producing findings from a very detailed multi-level model programme. Well-designed classrooms could improve pupils' progress in lessons by as much as 25%, and that's quite early day at the moment. Their main findings aren't out yet. And Ian Grosvenor and Kathy Burke's work, a school building can tell students who they are, what they should think, and what they should think about the world. So not only is there a claim from Barrett et al. About cognitive gain, but also the regulative aspect is also featured there in Grosvenor and Burke's claims. OECD, fairly recently, only 4 years ago, there's little existing research that focuses on how educational spaces are used as tools to facilitate the changing needs and demands of curriculum and pedagogy. And strangely for OECD, using the notion of tool there in a very Vygotskian sort of way. However, a growing body of literature highlights the need for learning environments to better respond to these needs and demands. In other words, we don't know enough about it. The project itself, we're looking at 300 students as they transfer from primary to secondary school, 9 case studies in which each case includes at least one primary and one secondary school, and we're looking at, we've now got the data on what young people were expecting their secondary school to be like from both new build and conventional schools, moving into particularly our 5 new build schools, but we're also tracking some of them who go into old build schools. So we've got some interesting comparisons there. And drawing on this work, which comes out of the Bartlett School of Architecture at UCL, humans shape their buildings through design practice. Social agency affects spatial structure. Humans shape their organizations through management practice, social agency affecting social structure. And buildings shape organizations, spatial agency affecting social structure. Then both organizations as well as buildings constrain agents in their behavior. Social structures and spatial structures, structure agency affecting social agency. And in turn, humans change the way they shape buildings and organizations, starting the cycle all over again. So a very complicated notion of what goes on when what you could say space becomes place, when people take over a space and make it into a place that they live and work in. And these are some of our buildings. This is a large, so architects call this a heart space. One of our schools is described, the design concept is jewels on a necklace. They didn't build the necklace, though, they forgot. this is another heart space, and so is this, and so is this. But these operate in very different ways, and I'm going to try. We've looked at the design process in detail. This is particularly working with a tremendously enthusiastic and energetic architect, young architect called Hao Ming Tse, who has pulled out some fascinating data, and we've done quite a lot of these interviews together, which highlight that different motives can result in conflicts and discontinuities, ensuring an educational vision gets translated into a material space. And so let's take a bit of this. So at the beginning, the introduction of BSF, the School Building Agenda, motives were social and educational reform. However, when it became local, that was to improve attainment and transform teaching and learning through personalization, ensuring community agents improve attainment for the school. And there was a little bit of resistance from the school, who wanted to continue traditional ways of teaching and learning. But eventually the school adopted the council's ideas. This particular school, they took 94 secondary school teachers to California to look at one school design. Just repeat that, 94 head teachers to California to look at the school design. And then transforming the educational vision into a design, the project management company, the motive was to deliver the project on time within budget to an agreed output. The architects wanted to maintain the practice reputation as good designers. The concept architects adopted the council's ideas, and at that time, a collaborative approach seemed to be working. Now, when they got to the point of getting the design and build team and the tender process came in, the partnership for schools locally, motive was to deliver a project on time, and there was a lot about winning the bid. But this is where some interesting conflicts build up. The preferred design was not chosen because of commercial interest. There was a conflict in the motives between financial and vision. The design consultants were not able to communicate directly with the end users. There was discontinuity with collaborative multi-agency working. There were a whole layer of different kinds of tensions and contradictions within what was essentially a complex multi-agency team. And sometimes communication was actually censored. So if the architect wanted to communicate with the end users, they had to do it through the consultancy company, and they would edit the emails because they didn't want certain kinds of message going through. Very complicated social practice, which has taken an enormous amount of time to pin down. Hao Ming and I did some very interesting interviews from my room when I was across the road. And of course, the technology failed, so we had to both lean against this phone. And we spoke to, firstly, the consultants involved, who talked about the difficulty in winning bids and what was then the climate. And the acoustic engineer we spoke to said, well, they came back with this idea about large open spaces. And as an acoustic engineer, I knew this wouldn't happen. I knew it wouldn't work because it wasn't possible to put enough acoustic paneling into the build to make it quiet enough to be a place where you could do teaching and learning. So amazingly, we have all of this on tape. The consultants then said, well, can't you write something? We will make every effort to ensure that BB, whatever it was, will be complied with. Oh yeah, sure, we'll do that. So everyone did that. In other words, constructing a bid that would be accepted, but actually also knowing that it would be very difficult to put that into place. So we've got contradictions in the design future. And then there's the question about how that's going to be used. So here's one example of a classroom. visibility is one of the big things in these designs. And it's amazing how many people talk about Jeremy Bentham. Those of you read the introduction to Discipline and Punish, the Foucault bit, there's the whole bit about the panopticon in that text. But interestingly here, lots of these floor-to-ceiling use of glass. But in some places, they've been blocked out. Now, in this school, the first head, there's been a change of head. The first head said, ah, I really like working in this school. I can go to one of four places, or so I can send people to one of four places, and we can see every child working in a classroom, so we know when trouble's going to start. And they have, this is a very formal school where all staff are required to wear a dark suit, they carry walkie-talkies, they have a hit squad waiting to move in if there's problems with some of the children. And I can see every child who is working, and so I know, this is really is permanent observation. That's the rationale for it. Sorry? Well, that was where the Bentham Panopticon came from, yeah. But of course, I mean, we all have it. Every traditional classrooms, little slit windows. Universities have those little slit windows. Some people paper them out, but there's a lot of stuff in architecture about doing this sort of visit. But here, as I said, but interestingly, in one of the other schools, same design feature. Head teacher said, I love working in this school because I know that the children can sit in a lesson and feel part of a wider learning community. So one was from the outside in, the other was from the inside out. That was the same, pretty much the same space that had been laid down, but as a place, it was becoming very different because the underlying argument of the occupying practice and understanding occupation as a practice, the underlying argument of the occupying practice was so different. Another part was the open plan. I taught, on my first teaching job was in an open plan school. And you can see what's gone on here. It's not only sort of putting pictures up on the wall, this is putting wardrobes and bookcases to cut up the space. So in some of the schools that do not want to occupy the space as a traditional space, not that which has been laid down, there are a variety of different mechanisms for carving the place up. Sue and I observed we were sitting about there in a lesson, which was very formal English lesson, and the design was that there would be three groups of children. They'd come together in a plenary session and go into breakout groups. They'd be able to personalise their learning. There would be heavy use of ICT, so they could follow their own thematic pathways through particular aspects of learning. But this was incredibly traditional. So you've got a design vision, which had come into place, but the vision really didn't work because there's a glorious group of people called value engineers who'd come in and say, well, you don't want all those, we can't afford all these acoustic baffles, so we'll take them out of the design. So the noise in those spaces is quite remarkable. This was the most radical of the change. This area, we've only got this photo because it was taken before our study started, but above this is an open area which the idea was that the children could go upstairs and see what people doing downstairs were doing. There's lots of, these are tiny rooms, the breakout spaces. And what happened to it was that top area got sealed over and completely changed because it was deemed not fit for purpose. So on the one hand, we're beginning to pick up a lot of stuff where the process of occupation is shaping the original design. There is a rejection of the vision argument that was in place there. But there's also other stuff. One of the things we've been doing, we asked young people to write an essay on the first 3 days in secondary school, and our terrific interns from Bath have done a really cracking job of analysing what was in those essays and whether there were references to the building or not, and so on and so forth. But essentially, the different pedagogic regimes give rise to different understandings and and perceptions of what was different and what are important places. And we've combined this, which, and this comes from the Bartlett School, this is a technology where you can see how visible you are in different parts of the school. So in a red part of the school, you're very visible, and a blue part of the school, you're hidden. And we've looked at all of these schools in using this technology. We did want to bug the kids and watch how they walk through it, but it didn't work. Although we have the idea of tying a bag of flour to their backs and seeing that. I'm not sure it'd be very, very popular. But there's something going on here about the relationship between the visibility issue, the availability of social space, and the perceptions of control on the part of young people. For high visibility, for the children to feel comfortable in high visibility spaces, they've got to be high trust within the school. Otherwise, they go nowhere near these big open heart spaces. In settings with high control, high visibility is perceived as a danger and talked about as a danger. Command control pedagogies give rise to timidity on the use of visible space. And what we're beginning to do at the moment is tease out these second order impacts of the way in which people's usage and the configuration of space operates. So what we think we need to do here is, and this is where I'm sort of pretty much going to finish, we need to develop strong principles of description of the cultural context of learning, which we can use to predict possibilities for communicative practice and then subject position. Studies of social, cultural, historical influences on the formation of mind be able to recover macro relations from the analysis of micro interactions. We're seeking to theorize and predict the consequences of different modalities of social regulation for discursive practice and the possibilities for subject position. To put it somewhat more firmly, we know in this university the RCT reigns, a randomized controlled trial is highly thought of. Nancy Cartwright has written with Jeremy Hardy a very interesting book on formation of public policy, in which she suggests that RCTs give you a sense of evidence that something works somewhere. And she cites things like the American, I think Louisiana or somewhere like that, where they showed through an RCT that reducing class size increased attainment. The governor of California, I believe it wasn't Schwarzenegger, but never mind, said, right, we'll do that in California. Spent millions and millions of dollars reducing class sizes. It made no difference. Just as with my favorite health story in Karelia, which is a part of Finland now, which in the formation of the country got carved in half. Half remains in Russia, half in Finland, where up until fairly recently, the main diet was butter and meat. And surprise, surprise, men tended to die very young, lots of them, with heart disease. Everyone got together and said, right, we need to change the diet. And given the climate, they could grow lots of raspberries and other red berries. And they shifted the diet. Heart disease fell away. The Strathclyde local regional government spent a fortune on replicating the same thing, and in Glasgow it made no difference. Now the question then is evidence relevant to a particular setting? And that seems to be the fight that's on today. To what extent have we got external validity on the evidence that we get from some kinds of RCT? Now, I'm sure in some aspects of medicine that's the case. But I think part of what I'm suggesting here is understanding how an intervention gets recontextualized into a particular setting requires us to understand the social, cultural, and historical processes of formation of mind. We've got to understand how cultures operate on interventions that come into them. So when Ian and I hopefully are going to look at how professional learning communities have been brought into the Oxford City Learning Schools, one of the things we'll be trying to do is understand how the idea of a professional learning community has been brought into Oxford schools, and they already acknowledge they're all different, but we're trying to get an analytic grip on how they are different. So that's That's a bit of an insight into the publicly acceptable sides of my imagination. And I hope you found it interesting. So thank you very much.